Hello, and welcome to The Issue on the ASGCT Podcast Network. I'm your host, Emily Walsh Martin. This episode is a special treat and features the CEO of Saleogen, Jason Cole. And we'll be covering Saleogen's new transposase-based technology for inserting genes into the genome without double-strand breaks. We chat about their initial data in Stargardt disease using an LNP to deliver to photoreceptors. But we also cover his path to Saleogen and how it feels to move from small molecule development to genetic medicines. And we'll close out with the value of using a target product profile as a guide to derive strategy around development. We hope you enjoy the conversation. But first, it is no secret that I love ASGCT's Policy Summit. And if you're listening to this and you're an R&D scientist or an analytical development expert or a clinical scientist or a program manager or a regulatory expert, and you find yourself needing to get the big picture of what it takes to ultimately deliver therapies to patients from bench to bedside to payer to access, then the Policy Summit is a must for you. I have never left this two-day meeting without having an amazing aha moment. So join me in DC, September 23rd and 24th, or online, for this crucial conversation between regulators, payers, patients, caregivers, and genetic medicine developers. You will not regret it. And now, on to my conversation with Saleogen's Jason Cole. Right. Welcome to The Issue on the ASGCT Podcast Network. Jason Cole, CEO of Saleogen, we are so happy to have you here today and hear a bit about not only your journey, but also Saleogen's latest journey developing novel therapeutics. But before we dive into the science of Saleogen, I'd love to hear a little bit about your own career path and how you got to your current role.
That sounds great. And Emily, I'm really glad to be here on The Issue with you. It's love to have these conversations about Saleogen. So my career path in biotechnology is a bit unconventional. So, you know, I've been working in and around biotech now for 20 some years. I'm a lawyer by training, so a corporate and transactional lawyer. I started my career at Ropes & Gray, which is this big international law firm, but in the Boston office. And I started working on deals with life sciences companies, right? So IPOs, venture financings, M&A, you name it. And I noticed that everyone having the fun was at the company. So they were these cross-functional teams of people who had a real purpose, right? Developing therapies for patients and their families. And so I was fortunate where a client who had just gone public, a company named Combinatorix, offered me the job to be their general counsel. And I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but I knew I was eager to leave a law firm and be part of these just really talented groups of people. And so that was an amazing experience. I learned, you know, how to be a manager. I learned a lot more about what it takes to discover, develop, and advance therapies. Unfortunately, a bunch of our therapies didn't work in phase two. And so we ended up doing a creative, you know, reverse merger to go after novel non-opioid targets in pain. That was also a great learning experience. And then what happened in that transition is I started the gradual process of changing my major from sort of a lawyer first to maybe a business person. Yeah. So I ended up, you know, working on a bunch of like operational groups, like facilities, IT, business development, corporate development. And so our therapies at Zalicus also didn't work in phase two, but then I was fortunate to really begin my gene therapy journey. And so I joined Bluebird Bio about a decade ago when the company was 100 people. We had the very beginnings of proof of concept data in our beta thalassemia program. And that allowed me to really join a company that was moving four first of their kind gene therapies to the clinic. And that was just a front row seat of all of the things that get you excited about genetic medicine, the patient impact, the things that are frustrating, the complexity, the cost, the access, reimbursement. But it was a tremendous ride. And so I was at Bluebird for 8.5 years, saw all sorts of scaling as we tried to build a fully integrated company across both CAR T and ex vivo gene therapies. In 2021, the board and the company decided that we should split in two because those two sort of pipelines and strategies were becoming increasingly divergent in terms of how we were operating. And so I spent most of 2021 cutting the company in two. So over that time, I'd become the COO of the company. And so I had to figure out both the transactional and operational aspects, which was fascinating. I don't know if I want to do that again in my career, but it was successful in creating these two independent gene therapy companies. I stayed at Bluebird, and that's when I sort of stopped doing the legal stuff, took on strategy, business development, finance, communications, and was really proud to get the company to our first two approvals of our gene therapies, Zynteglo and Skysona. I decided to leave Bluebird after those two approvals, really because I wanted to see if I could lead a company myself. I had done all the jobs I was probably qualified for at Bluebird, as I sort of changed my major. And I was really looking to find a company with a technology that was positioned where the future of gene therapy was going, at least in my opinion. And that means, non-viral, that means in vivo, and that means integrative. So kind of a really permanently in there in the host genome. And I was doing some consulting while I was interviewing, and I found Saleogen and found their technology, which was still being kind of more widely applied. And I was able, through networking, to get introduced to a member of the board who put me into an ongoing CEO search process. And I joined the company a little over 8 months ago. And I'm really enjoying my first CEO gig. It's a lot of fun to put teams together and try to create a new culture to focus pipelines, all of that. So I'm really fortunate to have found Saleogen as my first sort of CEO opportunity, and really excited to share our story at ASGCT a couple of weeks ago.
No, and what I love about your particular career path is that similar to mine, right? You started in small molecules, and actually yours was a little more complicated, right? Because combinatorics was actually built on the premise that maybe a single small molecule wouldn't be enough. You needed a combination to unlock new biology and what have you. And so you started on complicated small molecules maybe before moving into gene therapy. And I'm just before we dive into Saleogen, I'm just curious, when you landed at Bluebird, do you remember what those first couple of weeks were like? Like, what were those aha moments? Because for me, it's always around one and done, which I think is something we often say in the field, and it cuts both ways, right? It means you get one shot on goal unless you have a redosable LNP technology, which we'll talk about later. And so, like, tell me about like the aha moments you had maybe the first couple of weeks at Bluebird.
Yeah, so it came pretty fast. So when I joined the company, my very first executive team meeting, right, where I'd met people in the interview process, but this was the first, like, I'm here to work. Our chief medical officer, Dave Davidson, who's now over at Tessera, shared hot off the press data from our beta thalassemia program. And I think it was like 1 month or 2 month data from our first patient. And in that, in thalassemia, you're just trying to get a level of hemoglobin expression. And our programs had this little biomarker that you could trace that it was actually because of what we did. And he started sharing the sort of percentages and the levels that we were getting. And that was awesome because it was that could only be because of our intervention. That doesn't happen in nature. And so, when I was doing my homework around whether I should go into this crazy space of gene therapy, it was because of the sort of power of these medicines to have profound biological change with a single, intervention. And on my first day of work, I was like, well, there it is. So good choice. And so that was really eye-opening. But then simultaneously, the complexity was eye-opening, right? So we were working on our first IND for the sickle program in that same sort of first month. And our source of cells was from, bone marrow, right? Like not, mobilized. And that's complicated, right? But in the name of patients, that's what we wanted to start with to get into the clinic. So yeah, it's gene therapy. I love working in the field, partly because it's so complex and challenging.
Right, absolutely. I'm reflecting on what you just said. It feels like we sometimes have these sort of technological leaps, right, between version one and version two.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, those leaps often result in much better sort of either outcomes for patients or patient experience.
Correct.
And
Yeah.
so that's certainly a gratifying part of the field that we're in. So let's do a little bit of Sally Jen talk.
Sure.
At the ASGCT meeting this year, you guys presented on some initial data from the Stargardt program. Interestingly enough, if people missed this talk because there was a lot going on, if you registered for the meeting and you missed the talk, you can still go to the archive until June 21st, 2024, and actually download the talk and watch it again. So I encourage people to do that as well. But you were talking about your Saluoge-based gene editing program, and in Stargardt disease, which is a hereditary disease resulting in progressive vision loss. I think it would be great to give the audience a 101 on how Saluoge works, big picture of the approach, how is it delivered, how it avoids making double-strand breaks, where it targets, all the good stuff that inquiring minds want to know.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to do that. And after that little career intro, keep in mind this is a lawyer describing,
Right.
complicated genetic biology. But part of the job is that. So our technology, which we call gene coding, that's the way we sort of brand it. As I said before, it's a non-viral in vivo technology that is really good at putting large genes in specific places with perhaps better safety compared to some more historical gene editing approaches. So how the heck do we do that? So our base enzyme is something we call Saluoge, but it's a transposase. So this is a class of enzymes that have evolved in mammals over millions of years to move DNA around. And there's a belief that this is how evolution happens, how mammals continue to evolve and survive over time. So what we've done is we've taken some transposases and bioengineered them for therapeutic use to make them put genetic material in specific places to, solve areas of disease that have maybe not been solved by first and second generation, genetic medicine approaches. So how does that work? So the first place to start is a little bit to think about what our drug product is. So we've developed a lipid nanoparticle that has tropism to the photoreceptors in the retina. So we'll come back to that when we talk about Stargardt's later, but just picture a lipid nanoparticle, but not for the liver, for the eye. In that LNP are two things. One is an mRNA that encodes for our enzyme, and then the other is a donor DNA of our gene of interest. And what's interesting about our technology is there is no theoretical limit in the size of DNA that we can integrate. There are limitations when you think about what can be encased in an LNP or other
Right.
nanoparticles. That's really the limitation. But the way our technology works, that sort of donor DNA can be quite huge. So now to get to sort of how it actually works. So the mRNA goes into the cell, the ribosomes turn it into our enzyme, it goes into the nucleus where it meets the donor DNA. Once it's there, it grabs these TIRs on the donor DNA and then excises that donor DNA. It's a little linker that it just pops out. And then the enzyme searches the host DNA for a TTAA sequence. And the way our enzymes integrate is they have this specific non-random integration pattern that the company has been spending years characterizing and understanding. So unlike, say, a lentivirus that integrates anywhere, our enzymes are designed to just integrate at these TTAAs. So they're basically searching for a TTAA, and there are these hotspots or places where there's open chromatin or other places within the host DNA that it then finds. And then through basically a direct covalent link to both strands of the DNA, It directly transfers the gene into the host DNA with full fidelity. So there are a lot of other genetic medicine approaches these days that try to do reverse transcription, right? So it's, you know, I try to explain this to people. It's like translating from like Spanish to English. We're not translating from Spanish to English. We're just putting the whole darn gene in. And so what makes that different from, say, CRISPR-based approaches, which, you know, Jennifer Doudna and Dr. Charpentier have talked about, the genetic scissors, right? We don't have scissors. We don't cut and then have the repair that creates the edit. And when you do that cut and repair, you can have things like indels, right? Insertions or deletions. Right. There are other sort of genetic abnormalities that may occur. And I think those are things you don't worry about too much in, say, an ex vivo setting. But in an in vivo setting, I think we all need to be really thoughtful about how that works. So our technology doesn't do that sort of cut. And as a result, we have less of that sort of genomic instability risk is the idea. And so that's how it works. And what's interesting is those little TIRs or ITRs I talked about actually now act as a barcode. So mm-hmm. you can sequence DNA to then confirm that it is not integrated in a bad place. So yep. what we found is our integrations are in predominantly intergenic and intronic regions, right? So places where you're not going to mess a lot up. And we've continued to understand these insertion patterns. And one of our posters at the ASGCT conference was actually all about the work we've done to characterize that insertion pattern. But there's not like a guide RNA. There's not a landing pad. It is basically like a Lego block that can only go certain places. Yep. And then when it goes there, it fits in nicely is the analogy I try to use.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's basically hunting for this TTAA right. in the genome. My assumption, maybe I'm wrong about this, is that, you know, chromatin state around those TTAs may play a role in what's accessible, what's not accessible.
You are very correct. Yes. Okay. If the chromatin is more open, then those TTAs get hit. And if it is not as open, you know, that those don't get hit with as much frequency.
Got it. And then when you guys look at in detail at sort of the insertion sites, is it so the thing that was always crazy with indels, right? And yeah. so this is going back to my time, you know, being the program lead for at CRISPR Therapeutics.
Correct.
Right. So with the thing about indels, right, it could be a -1, it could be a +2, it could be a +3. Without cutting, my assumption is you're always going to have a TTAA flank in some fashion. Is it always, you know, split down the middle? Is it one side or the other? Like, how much variability in the actual insertion footprint, I guess?
Yeah, no, good question. So the poster we presented at ASGCT goes a little ways to sort of answering this, right? So a lot of that work was done in T cells, because that's mm-hmm. just a workhorse way to sort of prove this point. But we sure. take, you know, we look at DNA from just a donor, and that would have a certain, you know, topography, let's say, of how it looks. And then we'd integrate, in this case, a CD19. And you would not see different topography, right? Like, so you wouldn't see all these sort of indels around that insertion. And because we have this little barcode, it's like, oh, it's right there. We found it. And it's not these sort of big, you know, challenging insertions. Yeah. The interesting thing about our enzyme, right? So it is a dimer. So, you know, my scientists explained to me, it can go in this way or this way, right? And if we have time later, when we talk about our CF program, we're actually take advantage of that to create a more site-specific targeting approach and creating kind of DNA binding tools that have you even more specifically have it integrate. But okay. we're getting ahead of ourselves. But yeah. but that kind of sequencing data is how we gain confidence that we're not triggering double-stranded breaks. And, you know, it's just this sort of simple and elegant, you know, integration of a whole gene. And, you know, I try not to, you know, besmirch, you know, CRISPR and the other technologies out there, because I believe in the genetic medicine space, there's no like winner,
right?
You know, we want patients to win. And
right.
each of our tools and technologies may be better suited to different diseases, tissues, contexts. And I think what we found is ours, at least in the near term, has really nice application in some of these retinal diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of dives us into Stargardt. So as I recall the Stargardt, it is too big of a gene to stick into an AAV. So there were, like, I think other groups who were looking at Stargardts, but they were having to split it into two and then somehow have the two come together and do the right thing in a single cell. But your technology, because it's unconstrained by size, in theory can address this, right?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And this is what really attracted me to the company to begin with. So, when you think about the gene therapy revolution, the genetic medicine revolution, there's been a lot of progress in the eye, right? Like AAV, right? Subretinally delivered or delivered other ways. Luxturna is the first approved gene therapy. So there's been progress there. But then I think what the field discovered is, oh, that use case is, quote, easier because of the smaller gene, et cetera. And so Stargardt's is the most prevalent rare disease without an approved therapy. And it certainly doesn't have a gene therapy. And so what others have tried historically is either to use in vivo lenti, which has a bigger carrying capacity, but probably doesn't get to the photoreceptors, which is what causes the disease. Or to your point, the gene is 6.8 kilobases. You can't fit that whole thing in an AAV, so you got to break it in two. And hope or try to drive it to come together appropriately in the right place. That may work, but it's complicated, right? And as you know, genetic medicines, the more complicated it gets, the more you have CMC risk, you have all the things. So what's great about our technology is it's the large gene with a single, enzymatic construct. And then our lipid nanoparticle, the team here spent a lot of time doing screening campaigns to find an LNP that can get to the photoreceptors. And that has also been something that's really stymied the field. Because
Right.
the,
Yeah.
yeah.
I remember, like, people were, so I think you said you guys had 40% transduction efficiency. I may be
Correct.
misquoting. Which I, the audience seemed pretty impressed by that. I'm not a photoreceptor expert, but the audience seemed
Sure.
pretty impressed by that. So, like, that also is a leap forward, right?
Yeah, so there are a lot of things, right? So it's not only like being able to get to the photoreceptors with an LNP, because a lot of LNPs have been poorly tolerated. So ours is well tolerated, so that's good. But then in addition, the way you treat these retinal diseases through subretinal injection is you create this thing called a bleb. So I view it as like a little blister that the retinal surgeon creates in this space between the retinal pigment epithelium, the RPE, the back of your eye, and the photoreceptors. And so if we can get our LNPs into that bleb, the data we have suggests that that expression in the treated area is 40%. When we look at data from like the whole eye, we also see 40% reduction in this toxic metabolite that causes blindness. So if you can make that bleb bigger, which is easier to do in human beings than monkeys and mice, we are even more bullish on in the clinic having enough sort of exposure for the gene therapy to do its job.
Wow, that takes me down a couple of lines of thought. So the first line of thought being, I think you sort of summarized one of the key questions that people often ask when choosing an indication, which is, what's the minimum level of tissue correction I need to target in order to get, full tissue level benefit? And what I, you having been at Bluebird, there's a there it's a great example, right? There's a dogma where beta thalassemia, like, in theory, you don't have to have every cell corrected. You can law of mass action, if enough cells are corrected, it'll win the day. But with sickle
It's a
cell,
cellular population that will just be part of you, correct, for the rest of
exactly.
your life.
With sickle cell, you kind of want a more uniform correction, because, if enough uncorrected cells build up in a tiny little capillary, they could occlude and have a vaso-occlusive event. So it's so what I'm understanding you say about Stargardt's is that you are seeing potentially some sort of tissue level benefit at a distance from your sort of local correction near to a bleb. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is the only photoreceptors we correct will be within that bleb. I think in human beings, we'll have the opportunity to make it larger to expand the potential impact. It's actually an open question among experts in the field about what level's enough, right? Like how many photoreceptors do you have to correct to have a therapeutic benefit? There's some old papers that are actually going at this backward that sort of say, how many photoreceptors do you have to still have to be able to see if you have Stargardt, right? Because you go blind from the inside out. And so that level is like 10 to 15%. I think folks who've been working in the Stargardt space think it's probably like more like 30 to 40. And so the data we shared a couple of weeks ago is why the folks in the room were like, oh, yay, that's what we want to see. And right before ASGCT, I was at ARVO hanging out with all the ophthalmologists, and they were also quite encouraged by the preclinical data they've seen with this program so far.
And I guess with using an LNP as opposed to an AAV, while you might be able to increase the bleb, you might also have the ability to redose, or is that not the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I in this indication, I don't emphasize the ability to redose. I think it's theoretical, but then the funny thing about transposases is, they're colloquially jumping genes. So they can we leverage them to put stuff in. They can take stuff out, right? And so what's great about our enzymes is they have this really short half-life. And the same thing with the mRNA delivery. So we actually want to get in and get out of those cells. So if you think about redosing, we probably don't want to remobilize where we already put it.
You'd
And
have to go into a
so,
new territory, which
correct.
you might not have enough space to do in the eye.
Correct. Or like I'd have to engineer, I'm not in the lab. Our team would have to re-engineer like a different sort of way of targeting it, right? So we've generated some redosing data in other indications, but I think when I think about like the commercial and kind of patient impact of gene therapies, one and done is the goal, and we think we can achieve.
That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about cystic fibrosis as well. So
Sure.
that's one that you're pursuing with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, yes?
It is correct. Yeah. So when I think about, as we talked about, Stargardt's is like an ideal application of the advantages of our technology. I think CF is the next sort of broader, maybe systemic application of our technology. So in this case, right, what we're trying to do is the CFTR gene is smaller. It's 4.4 kilobases, right? But when we talk with our investor slash collaborator at the CF Foundation, what they want is if you're going to integrate that thing, they want you to integrate it in a very specific place, right? So intron one of where the CFTR gene is normally. And so that means we need to engineer our enzyme to be site specific. So we've got a lot of different really cool strategies to do that. Part of how we do it is we actually use an approach to mutate our base enzyme to take away its natural ability to find that TTAA. So it keeps its ability to excise, to grab the gene, but then we take it away to give it back with zinc fingers. So we had a poster a couple of weeks ago at ASGCT where we're working with this group that uses AI and machine learning to develop these zinc fingers for these very specific parts of intron one where we want to put the CF gene. So we can then get target specificity there. So the gene is under endogenous control. So there's concern in the field that you don't want to overdo it, right? You don't want to have all these promoters and things that might overshoot the expression you're trying to do. So we're trying to kind of put the full length normal gene in its appropriate home, as it were, to address cystic fibrosis. And what's interesting about this program for us is there are 2,000 mutations that cause the disease we call CF. The approved therapies cover about 90% of that. So there are 10% of patients that do not have a therapy at all, right? So they're waiting for their intervention. We could address that because our approach is, mutation agnostic. It's just the whole gene. But there are a bunch of patients on the existing, potentiators and correctors who are intolerant to those therapies, right? They don't tolerate them well. They don't respond well, and that may be up to 20% of those patients. And so what we're trying to do is come up with a one-time therapy that would certainly help the patients with nothing, but then also potentially displace these lifetime chronic therapies that CF patients will be, basically have to take for their whole life. And the delivery side of this, so we're not coming up with our own LNP internally. What we're doing now is partnering with innovators in the nanoparticle space who are working on these LNPs that avoid the liver systemically and only go to the lung. So we're not taking an inhaled aerosolized approach. We'd like to get to the basal stem cells. And because our technology can fully integrate, we kind of go in the back door and then have those lung epithelial cells be corrected and then potentially, you know, correct the disease.
Right.
But this is a big, audacious sort of goal. But I think as a company, we have the tools to go after this one-time all genotype cure. So let's do it. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think what you just said there sort of hammers it home for me. When you have a platform technology like this, right? I can imagine that not a day goes by before you think of another use case. And so when you're sitting there and you're working with the team to try and figure out what to prioritize and how to pick your first and second and third shots on goal, how did you guys approach this and sort of what were the key considerations? Obviously, Stargardt's makes sense. It's something that's not particularly, well suited by some of the more traditional therapies, CF as well, right? Mm-hmm. People have been trying and are still trying with inhaled approaches with vanilla gene, what I call vanilla gene therapy. But how did you guys think about, big picture, what are our favorite indications that we could use this for?
Yeah, so that was what I did in my first 2 months at work, basically, because, we have this really promising platform, but, sometimes startups can fall in love with their platform, or you can have a bias toward applications that were maybe the favorite of like your, academic founder or whatever. And so I think it's really important to have the discipline of what is differentiation. And that differentiation is not just biologic. So in our case, we're the big gene people. So we should probably focus on things that are large genes where others can't quite get it there. Clinical, medical, what is the disease state? Do we have a reason to believe that we can achieve transformative, efficacy in that disease? And is that something that is precedented from a clinical development perspective? Or not, right? Am I validating endpoints, or are we leveraging endpoints that others have, quote, validated, but just not been successful? And then I think it's really important to bring in the competitive / commercial context. I think they're often, when companies are formed, that perspective is maybe deprioritized, or that data isn't, brought in as well. You and I were talking a little bit about, my background. I've learned in my time in biotech that I'm quite often the dumbest person in the room I'm in, but I'm usually good at asking the question around scientific data, commercial opportunity, epidemiology, endpoints. And so as a company, that's really how we approached this, to say, okay, there's a clear differentiation story in Stargardt's. We believe there's a potential differentiation story through other inherited retinal diseases and the CF example I gave you next. As we think about what's next, we're just going to use that same set of filters to make sure what we're doing is plausibly differentiated in the relevant time period, right? Because, gene therapy has exploded, genetic medicines have exploded. There are people ahead of you, us, in certain areas that are really interesting. What's the argument that ours, if not is first in class, is best in class? Yeah. And those arguments, I think, have to be really convincing to be a second but best in class.
Yeah.
And I just think it's about surrounding yourself with smart people and data to make those, often hard prioritization decisions.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree with you. The bar does appropriately seems to need to change after you have something that's at least starting to address the needs of patients, right? You have genetic therapies will be doing a disservice to the patients we're trying to treat if we want to be me too. Like, right. We need to differentiate. And I think, yeah, it sounds like that's what you guys are trying to do, is really figure out where this fits in the pantheon of options for the various unmet needs out there, right?
Yeah, and I think one thing, I can't appropriately cite it, but I think I read a really good article a couple of years ago about in gene therapy, the title was, "If you're not first, you're last," right? And it's kind of the Talladega Nights joke. And they had a bunch of examples around, you know, if you're able to successfully get uptake and launch, which, as we all know, has been varied across our field, right?
Right.
But it's hard to enroll trials. It's hard to get KOL engagement. It's hard to get investor capital if you struggle to articulate a value proposition that is not, you know, we are the first therapy for this disease where there was nothing before.
Right.
And I think just folks who run companies and manage resource allocation, you just got to be really disciplined about that.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And it you know, in particular, I think of fields like CF, perhaps, where it is reasonably crowded, right? There are periods of time where you might have 1, 2, 3 trials enrolling for the same subset of patients, those patients who are not well served by potentiators and modulators. And so it really, what I have been impressed with, and this is even hearkening back to my days in hemophilia once upon a time, is that not only are providers becoming incredibly educated about the genetic medicines that we're trying to develop, but as well the patients are, and they're weighing their options, right? And so in God we trust, everybody else bring data, right? And so how, when you guys think about that, obviously there's the set of data that you're going to have to pull together for Stargardt's to satisfy the regulators, but then there's also that set of data that you need to satisfy yourself and then satisfy, you know, the providers and patients. And do you guys think about your development plans in that, in all those aspects of when you're putting together, like, which animal studies and how long and that kind of thing?
So I think the honest answer is we aspire to have that comprehensive of a sort of set of analyses, but we're also a small biotech company.
Right.
So
there are,
you know, I've worked at companies with various levels of resourcing, and, you know, there's the opportunity to do that, you know, patient funnel, which I'm sure you've seen, right? Where it's like, okay, here's the epidemiology. Here's actually how many are eligible. This is how many are under healthcare. And you get to these like true kind of like eligible patient numbers. We haven't done that at Saliagen yet, but we will. And I think we will when it comes time to take our target product profile or TPP and make it real through the endpoints we pick and I'll call the later stage clinical development. And so there's a bit of, it's not gut, but it's like enough data to feel positive about it. And then as your product performs preclinically or clinically, then you can adjust your TPP. You could test it. You could say, well, if it's only that, do I have a shot? Or if it's only that, we have to, you know, run another study. And then you get into these, you know, like kind of sometimes tough decision moments.
Right.
So one of the things I've learned over time, and it's from a lot of, you know, good program executive, program leader types, is the power of a target product profile and staying disciplined around, this is what we're trying to achieve. And if we don't achieve that, you know, should we be doing this?
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I've seen them where there's aspirational and, you know, all these different versions.
Right. But, different columns for the different levels of aspiration. Absolutely. This
base level TPP aspirational, you know,
Well, and I'm glad we're talking about the target product profile, because I actually don't think we've talked about that on one of these podcasts. And I think for me, you know, when I first joined industry coming from academia as a postdoc, that was the first sort of aha moment of you kind of need to know where you're going. And for people who haven't, like, used a target product profile in their discovery efforts before on the podcast. You know, the way I like to think of them, it's almost your miniature version of your label. So if you look up any drug, you know, look up their label, like your target product profile is going to start to try and answer all those questions. And some are going to be, I don't know yet, but some of it has to be, okay, here's the study that's going to tell me what that answer is.
Yeah. And you know, they are appropriately aspirational when you're at a company like mine that's preclinical.
Yeah.
And as you advance the program, it becomes more reality oriented, right? Because you have data that can say, you know, what you're getting to. But, you know, I believe that's another good kind of biotech discipline to, okay, why are we here? What are we trying to bring into the world that maybe no other company can bring into the world?
Yeah.
Let's just write it down. And, you know, biology can be cruel, and maybe this will never see patients outside of a clinical setting. But if that unfortunate end comes, it's because we haven't achieved that profile. And that includes safety and efficacy, very basic elements of drug development. So I love that stuff. And I think it focuses the mind of cross-functional teams, because it's easy for folks on those teams to get stuck in their particular discipline,
right?
Like, I'm here to deliver this set of experiments, this attribute, and it's actually a whole. And, you know, it's like, open your hymnals to this page, because this is what we're trying to achieve.
Well, and absolutely. And I think, you know, maybe I just have, you know, poor memory, but I believe that it's even for genetic medicines, it's even more critical that we come together cross-functionally. And we obviously no one should overstep necessarily their function, but also we should also be infinitely curious about every other function and how, you know, their decisions might impact ours and, you know, how their data may impact ours. And so that's, I think teams that can do that successfully and center it around a target product profile that's truly differentiated have the best shot to really change things for patients.
And that was another eye opener for me when, you know, again, back to my Bluebird days. You know, I think CMC and my previous companies, right, small molecules, was like critical, important, but not the same, right? It's like, wait, the patient is part of the supply chain?
Right.
like we have to create this whole journey for them to get their cells out, then to get their cells back and you know, all the quality attributes of that. And so the seat at the table that people from, you know, CMC and supply chain and quality have in a genetic medicines company is outsized appropriately.
Yeah.
And to your point, you're probably not a great program leader, program executive, or just drug developer if you tune out when they're talking, right?
Right.
Because, you know, I think one of the learnings around Bluebird and our sickle program was, you know, that first phase one study, there were a lot of attributes to our process and approach that we didn't have right the first time.
Yeah.
And so we had to adjust in the clinic, and we did, and that eventually became an approved therapy. But, you know, that getting that right is so critical, and it it requires that cross-functional problem solving and awareness. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we're at the end of our time,
okay.
But I get my favorite last question, which is, if you could wave a wand and fix one thing about genetic medicines development, what would it be?
Sure. So if I could wave a wand, I would like to figure out how we can get access to genetic medicines for ultra rare diseases. Mm. I think, you know, as a society, we have given companies, corporations, the bargain to develop therapies for patients. And I think the complexity and cost of a lot of genetic medicines makes the cold capitalist calculus for ultra rare impossible.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen a lot of this in the past few years where with tighter capital markets and access to capital, a lot of companies have had to discontinue programs for really rare diseases. And these are programs that have the technologies there, the science is there, there's a cure there, but we can't get it there.
And so this magic wand would have to touch all sorts of parts of the ecosystem,
Yep.
right? Because I mean, there's probably new business models, there's probably a different approach to regulatory, there's probably different approaches to things like quality, policy changes, incentives. But I, as we said earlier, the power of genetic medicines is so profound,
Yeah.
and there shouldn't be like a you have to be this tall to get a gene therapy, like in terms of your epidemiology.
Yeah.
And I have direct experience of this from Bluebird at CALD, but I don't think there are many companies who develop a CALD drug
Right.
anymore. And this is a hard thing. I know there are people working on it and thinking of creative models, but that just for like society, we have these amazing medicines. We need to get them to everybody who can benefit.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, part of the challenge, right? Well, and it's similar to, I think, what you are describing you're going to do with, rare eye diseases, right? You're starting with Stargardt's to proof of concept, proof of mechanism, and then that'll open doors, right? And I'm hopeful that with a continued focus by our entire industry on publishing long-term data, like understanding what's working, what's not working, where we're sort of falling short, we can identify, what the right approach is for those rare diseases, and then figure out how to make it scale, right?
Because I think the FDA and the industry have been talking for decades now about like what does a platform approval mean?
Right.
And I really applaud what like Peter Marks has done by creating the super office and the OTP, because you could envision a world where sponsors like Saliagen or any number of companies in our space, it's like, okay, I'm using the same LNP
Right.
manufactured at the same place for the drug you just approved. The enzyme is the same.
Right.
The only thing that's different is this.
Yeah.
So could we just focus on this part,
Right.
right?
Right. I'm still going
And
into the photoreceptors or what have you. I'm still like need to achieve the same level of correction. I'm just switching out what I'm replacing. Yeah.
And it's almost like a master file of
Yeah.
your fundamental
Yeah.
kind of whether it's delivery or genomic medicine platforms, and then the only thing you're swapping out is the genetic payload. Now, so we'll probably get close to that at some point in time, but I don't see it right around the corner.
Yep. No, I fear you are correct, but I'm hopeful that with continued focus we can get there. Well,
Me
thank you
too.
so much, Jason Cole, for taking your time to join us on the podcast today. And
Sure.
yeah, really appreciate all the knowledge you shared, and good luck with everything at SaliGen.
Thank you, Emily. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks a lot.